Now, there's been a dramatic increase in the number of dead dolphins and whales being washed up on our beaches. This year is shaping up to be the worst since records began, according to the Irish Whale and Dolphin Group. This extract from a report for RTE News is by Sean McIntyre.
It's an adult pilot whale. It's a male, you can see that.
The latest in a spate of dead strandings.
It's a good 5 metre animal.
But there's even more on this beach.
Just on this 100 metres of beach, 4 dead dolphins and the dead pilot whale.
The Irish Whale and Dolphin Group says the number of dead strandings over recent weeks is unprecedented.
That report from Sean McIntyre in West Kerry, featuring Nick Massett of the Irish Whale and Dolphin Group, was broadcast in March of this year. April is seeing this worrying trend continue, with 2 adult and 1 juvenile Cuvier's beaked whales washed up in Donegal among the carcasses found so far this month. We're joined now from his home in Kilrush in County Clare by Dr. Simon Barrow, the Chief Scientific Officer with the Irish Whale and Dolphin Group. Simon, good to talk to you. How's everybody in Kilrush today?
They're great, Derek. The sun is shining and the birds are singing.
Good to hear it. Let's begin by talking about these Cuvier's beaked whales.
Cuvier's beaked whales are interesting species. They're deep diving species which live on the shelf edge in deep water. They're officially the deepest diving marine mammal species on the planet. And we've had 4 washed up already this year, which might not sound very many, but normally we'd only get sort of 3 or 4 during the whole year. So to get 3 reported in the first 3 months, it's not unprecedented. I'm not overly concerned yet, but if this carried on, then we would start raising flags up. And I suppose, Derek, the important thing about the Irish Whale and Dolphin Group stranding scheme is to look at long-term trends and identify unusual stranding events. So, for example, in 2018, we got 28 Cuvier's beaked whales washed up in a 6-week period, which was unprecedented. And this same thing happened in Scotland, and it turned out to be the biggest unusual mortality event of this species anywhere in the world. And as the event unfolded, we detected it first in Ireland. So that is unusual. So I'm not too concerned about the ones yet, but we need to continue monitoring to see, is this going to turn into another UME, an unusual mortality event?
Simon, what are the candidate explanations for such an event? What is the prime suspect?
When we get a stranding event, we look at the pattern of the event. Is it many animals? Is it over a short period? Is it geographically isolated? Are they in good condition? Are they rotten? And it's by looking at the pattern of the event and the species involved that makes us think what could be the potential cause of it. So if they were spread over a wide area and coming in different body conditions, so fresh and rotten, then it's likely that the event is not connected. These strandings are not connected. But if it's in the same area over a short period and say it all in poor condition, then we'd be suspect these would be more connected. And typically for Cuvier's beaked whales or all the beaked whales, the prime suspect is acoustic trauma. Beaked whales are very, very sensitive to sound of certain frequencies. And the navies, not the Irish Navy, because we don't have this kind of kit, but they use active sonar, which is peaking about 38 kilohertz. And that coincides with what we think the whales use for communication. And they're particularly vulnerable. So we would flag concerns about acoustic trauma and naval exercises. And it's true that when these mass stranding events have occurred all around the world, they've nearly always been associated with naval exercises. The trouble is, in Ireland, we don't know what's happening beyond the horizon. They're not obliged to inform the Irish government about any military exercises or any use of this active sonar. So beyond the 12 miles, they can do what they like. So if you like, the stranding record give you a suggestion of what might be happening offshore. They reflect activity that's going on that we might not be aware of. So it is a big issue because, of course, when you ask navies, were you using this equipment, they won't tell you because of security. So it's a kind of long battle, I suppose, to gain trust and dialogue between things like the Irish government, the Irish Whale and Dolphin Group, and these foreign navies. Because what we'd like them to do is avoid areas where we know are important to species that are sensitive to this gear. And we know for sure that the northwest slopes of Ireland are really good habitats for deep diving species throughout the year, but especially at certain times of year. So we would say to the Navy, avoid this area at this time of year. And by that, we'll avoid these unnecessary deaths.
Didn't they move out from the Canary Islands on the advice of whale experts because the military exercises there were causing lots of problems? The submarine detectors are doing the same thing as whales. They're sending out a pulse and it bounces off the submarine they're looking for and it comes back so they know that there's a sub there and they're able to estimate how far away it is. Now, if they send out a solar pulse, is this something kilometres long or is it something that goes on for tens of kilometres or hundreds of kilometres? Is the pulse a lethal pulse that sweeps the entire range of ocean?
It's likely to be tens of kilometres. Of course, the further away you are from the sound source, the less catastrophic the impact is. So to actually cause these animals to surface so fast that they get the bends and ultimately die of that, then they probably need to be within tens of kilometres. But you'll have a behavioural reaction possibly within hundreds of kilometres where they might avoid the area. And there's been some really neat controlled exposure experiments with colleagues in kind of Norway and Scotland where they put tags on the whales. They then expose them to active sonar from different distances and they look at the reaction. So it's quite well studied now. Now you need to do more work on more species, but it does show that the beaked whales, Cuvier's beaked whales, northern bottlenose whales, are particularly sensitive to this kind of activity, as are sperm whales and others. So, you know, I think we need to understand how the whales react, and then we need dialogue with the perpetrators, if you like, and an open dialogue. And I think it also pushes us into the realms of marine protected areas, which are a huge topic in Ireland now. So if we know those areas that are particularly good habitats for particular species, then maybe we should designate them as marine protected areas and have management plans that manage the events in it. So if they're only there during the summer and autumn, these activities, such as naval exercises, should not be allowed in this area for that duration. And I think this way gives it a much better management structure. And, you know, you're right, Richard, the Navy was excluded from the Canary Islands. So they're looking for other areas to carry out these naval exercises. So it's important that we identify the areas that they shouldn't be in. And maybe they can then identify areas that are less sensitive to their activities. There's actually an exercise due at the end of April. So it'll be interesting to see, will we get any increase in strandings of beaked whales during that period? I mean, it should be remembered that this year, 2021, is the worst we've ever had for the number of stranded animals on Irish coasts. In the first 3 months of this year, we recorded, the Irish Whale Dolphin Group Stranding Scheme, 199 stranded animals. Last year, in the same period, there was 108. The year before, there was 75. The year before, there was 105. So we've nearly had a doubling of strandings this year already compared to previous years. And those strandings are dominated by common dolphins, not beaked whales. We've had, I think, 11 species of whales and dolphins recorded already this year. But by far, most of them are common dolphins. So there's something really strange going on with common dolphins. Some of this activity would be fisheries bycatch, and we've been concerned about this for a number of years. But it's really interesting that there's increased evidence that there's been an inshore movement of common dolphins from deep offshore waters into the coastal waters along the whole western seaboard of Europe, from the Bay of Biscay all the way up to north. So if there's more dolphins closer to shore, then you would expect more strandings because the proportion of those animals die naturally. So I think it's really important when we're talking about strandings and causes of them is to try and distinguish, if you like, the signal from the noise. What's the natural mortality? What would we expect to see? What's being caused by human activity, be it fishing, be it naval exercises? What's caused by changes in distribution? And, you know, due to climate change, we're living in unprecedented times. So if the dolphin distribution is changing to what we would expect, then we're going to see changing patterns in the strandings. And typically they would change because their prey, fish, move as well. And they're moving because water temperatures are changing. So there's quite a lot of kind of messages that come through the stranding scheme. And the challenge to us as a group is to try and tease apart things that we think have an important conservation implication and communicate our concerns and the numbers to our National Parks and Wildlife Service and government and identify management that needs to take place. So it's a case of identifying causes that we would have concern with. So it's a brilliant example. I mean, this stranding scheme is run by volunteers, citizen scientists, who visit stranded animals. We train them up in how to identify, measure, and take a skin sample for the genetic tissue bank, which is hosted at the Natural History Museum in Dublin. This army of citizen scientists is producing really, really good quality data that is informing conservation management. So, all power and all strength to citizen scientists throughout Ireland.
Yeah, but you can't be sure why an animal died if you don't carry out an autopsy, a post-mortem, correct?
Yeah, the lack of post-mortem programme in Ireland is disturbing in some ways. Now, in fairness, the Marine Institute of the National Parks and Wildlife Service did run a three-year pilot project, which we won and delivered in collaboration with the regional vet lab in Cork. And this was to establish the cause of death from a sample of common dolphins, striped dolphins and harbour porpoises, and to see what proportion we attributed to fisheries bycatch. So we work with Jim O'Donovan down the regional vet lab in Cork, and we're still working up the case history report. So we haven't finished this project yet. To be honest, distinguishing death by drowning is quite difficult pathologically. So there's an element of training and building capacity. But there's no doubt, Derek, that we need a post-mortem project in place in Ireland. We need to recover things like beaked whales in good condition for post-mortem, not just to learn about the causes of death, but to learn more about the life of the animal through diet studies and reproductive rates and contamination and age structures. So I think we could, using resources that are available through the regional vet labs, through the National Parks and Wildlife Service, through the local authority veterinary network, which is fantastic. You know, we should have a program in place where a sample of these strandings are post-mortem, so we understand what's going on. Because if we decided, oh my goodness, there's a huge increase in common dolphins, what's causing it? What do we do? What are the actions? We don't really know if we don't know what the cause of death is. So it is. The two things should run in parallel. So hopefully now, when we finished this pilot project and made our recommendations, that this will spark an interest in doing this kind of work, because we actually have the resources in place. It wouldn't cost a lot of money. It's really just logistics, recovering animals to vet labs, training up our vets, having a standardized procedure, maybe working with UCD as well and the vet lab there, and start building up knowledge on the cause of death and the life of these animals.
Simon, what should a member of the public do if they happen to come across a stranded whale or dolphin on a beach?
That's a good question. Yeah, we've been running the stranding scheme now for nearly 30 years. So we've got a good long-term data set. I think in the early years, we can't be too reliant on the data because there were less people involved, so there's more recording going on. But in the last 10 or 20 years now, the recording has been quite stable. You know yourself, Niall, from the bird recording schemes, you need to make sure you control the effort made to make a record. So people are sending records in online, and we have a new reporting app coming out in the next couple of weeks to make it easy for people on the ground, not just strandings, but sightings as well. And these records that you put in through the app will go straight into the database. They're then validated, which is absolutely essential if we're going to believe the data. So the stranding and sighting records are validated. And then when we're happy they are accurate, we then put them up on the website for everyone to see. So there has been a slight, I don't know if you've seen it, there's been a slight COVID effect this last year. Last year, 2020, we've had the highest number of sighting records ever sent to the Irish Whale and Dolphin Group. So I think there has been a slight increase in recording effort. People are more interested. It's been slightly made easier through social media, apps, websites. But I don't think that has impacted on our trends, that we're still confident that the data, the increase in strandings is not just increased recording, it's a real effect. So it's never been easier for people to get interested involved in wildlife, get interested in wildlife recording, and to make a real difference, because these data, as you know, I mean, how many of the birdwatch recording schemes underpin really, really good policy advice? There's one just come out this week. So I think it's good for people to know that if they support our recording schemes, which are robust scientifically, the data is used, will be believed and is credible, and will go to supporting conservation actions and policies.
Simon, I have a question for you about what goes on in a school of dolphins or whales. Now, each of them is navigating by sonar. In other words, you send out a stream of pulses and the echo of those pulses coming back tells you there's an object in front and so on and so forth. Now, if you have 20, 30 such animals all sending out pulses together, there must be an almighty cacophony of sounds going out and coming back. So do they opt out? After all, if one sends out a pulse, all hear it going out, all hear it coming back. They don't need to send out their own. It's duplication, unnecessary duplication and unnecessary confusion if they all start transmitting. So is it the case that a leader takes over, sends out the overall pulses, and the others follow him? It would explain a mass stranding. Is there anything in that theory?
Well, it's an interesting theory, and I like the way you're thinking, like a whale, a dolphin in the group. I don't think it's quite as simple as that, because when a dolphin echolocates, it then has to receive that signal back. And as you know, sound in water is omnidirectional. You don't know where it's coming from. So to achieve directionality for an animal to see, you know, where is the object that it's hit, be it a fish, a prey item, or maybe to navigate, it actually points its lower jaw. So it points its lower jaw at the returning sound, and it directs it through transmitting it along its lower jaw into its ear bones, which are situated at the very tip, the inside, if you like, of the lower jaw. So that gives it directionality. So if another animal clicked, I'm not sure you'd be able to receive that through your lower jaw as accurately. I can't see how it would quite work. So I don't think it's a case of one animal clicking and the rest listening in. I think the individual has to click to receive its own echolocations click back to itself. But of course, they don't just echolocate, they use a whole variety of vocalizations to communicate with each other, including, you know, whistles and groans and gunshots and a whole variety of sounds. And each dolphin has its own unique whistle. So they recognize themselves and they'll recognize each other's. So if they're communicating with each other to maintain that group cohesion, for example, they'll be using whistles and other vocalizations, not clicks. Clicks are really to find prey and navigate. But it's an interesting one. Do they eavesdrop on each other? Certainly predators such as killer whales would eavesdrop on the vocalizations of their prey, be them seals or dolphins. And if there's killer whales around, the dolphins stay silent, because they don't want to be eavesdropped on. And it's the same with the mother and calf. Stay quiet. Don't communicate. Maybe communicate by touching so you maintain close contact. So there obviously is an acoustic warfare going on within whales and dolphins and predator and prey. And I suppose we're only just really kind of touching on understanding how interesting and important that is. So it's a good question. I think when you're thinking whales and dolphins, you have to think acoustically, because they live in an acoustic world, which is very alien to us. So if we are going to understand how they live and the pressures they're under, we need to think acoustics, you know. And you have to remember that we're living in a generation now, an era now, where the background noise in the oceans is increasing, has been increasing for the last 50 years. So there's great concern about the impact on whales and dolphins. It could be quite subtle. It could mask the sounds they make. So maybe 50 years ago, producing sound of this energy could transmit 40 or 50 kilometres. But because with the increase in ocean sound, mainly through shipping, that same energy might only now communicate over 20 or 30 kilometres. So their sound is masked. What impact does that have on them? What impact does it have on their ability to communicate with each other, especially the big whales that might be communicating over hundreds of kilometres? And how much does that mean they have to use more energy to communicate the same levels they would have done 40, 50 years ago? And if you use more energy, you have less energy for other things. So it's a fascinating area, and it's something that there's some really good work coming out looking at sound and how it impacts on whales and dolphins. And under the Marine Strategy Framework Directive, which is a big directive out of Europe, we're actually legally obliged to understand noise and how it affects not just whales and dolphins, but fish as well. A lot of fish are very acoustic because sound is now defined as a pollutant. So we have to measure that pollutant, measure the impact of that pollutant, and ultimately control that pollutant. So that directive has opened up a whole massive amount of extra research on acoustics and the impact. So it's a fascinating subject. And as you said, really, really important.
Simon, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Derek.
And that's pretty much all we have time for today. My thanks to all of our contributors, Simon Barrow, Niall Hatch, Richard Collins and Dana Nilana. Our broadcast coordinator is Jara Tholland. Our researcher is John Bella Riley. Until next time, goodbye.